Hey, listeners. I'm Karen Riley Jeffers, NCSM's Eastern 2 Director. Welcome to our series, Learning with Leaders, Everyone Belongs in Mathematics. Thank you for joining me and my co-host, Abel Maestas, the host of Teaching That Counts, as we talk with both leaders and influencers about their math journeys and contributions. Today, we will hear from our special guests about their inspiration, perceptions, and insights regarding instructional decisions that make the mathematics space welcoming and engaging to all. Listen and learn about how beliefs, practices, and policies must continue to advance to ensure that each and every person feels a sense of belonging in mathematics.
All right, welcome everybody to the Learning with Leaders podcast and the NCSM's monthly podcast. My name is Abel Maestas, as always, and our co-host, of course, is
Karen Riley Jeffers.
And we welcome everybody to the podcast this month. I'm super excited. I do have to say this, so everybody knows, Karen, we started this, we took over the podcast almost a year, right? Mm-hmm. We, I think, came on about October or November, and so here we are, almost our year anniversary, and then both of us are having our 50th birthdays this year, which is pretty cool, and yours is coming up, so happy birthday.
Thank you, because this will be the September release, and so by the time, once everybody starts to hear it, my birthday will be in a couple weeks after, so thank you.
Yeah, all the listeners out there are going to be singing happy birthday on their walk or their drive to work whenever they're listening to this podcast. I encourage you all to sing happy birthday to Karen, so happy birthday as this comes out. All right, so I am super excited about our guests this month. We have a great guest. Those of you out there listening that will be at the NCSM conference in October, you can catch our guest there. And I hope you go out and listen to all the great things she has to share with everyone that comes to all the participants. So we'd like to welcome Deborah Peart-Creighton to our podcast this month.
So glad to be here.
But I'd like to introduce Deborah to everyone here. So Deborah is the founder of and queen mather of My Mathematical Mind. She is the author of Readers Read, Writers Write, Mathers Math, Bridging the Gap Between Literacy and Mathematics. Deborah is a doctoral candidate focused on finding solutions to support elementary educators with improving math teaching efficacy by leveraging the competence found in teaching literacy. She's dedicated her career and doctoral studies to supporting educators with innovative teaching strategies that allow students to be curious problem solvers and see themselves as assets to the learning community. Deborah believes all children deserve high-quality instruction, joyful learning experiences, and the opportunity to become competent and confident readers, writers, and mathers. So thank you again, Deborah, for joining us this month.
It is my pleasure. I'm super excited to see everyone at NCSM and also to hear your thoughts about this episode that we are about to record.
I'm excited too. Deborah is going to be our closing keynote speaker, and it's going to be awesome. I had the privilege of attending and being the presider over one of the sessions last year, and it was pretty impactful. So super duper excited that you are joining us today. I know Abel just introduced you, but if you will share some of your journey in education that has led you to your current work so our listeners can hear more about how you've reached the place where you are today.
Thank you so much, Karen. It would be my pleasure. So I am one of those people that you hear that at 7 years old, I knew I wanted to be a teacher, and I was always helping and staying at the end of the school year to clean up so I can take the unused workbooks home and play school all summer long. So I've always loved learning, but I was all about literacy, all things phonics, reading, writing. I was obsessed with words, loved words so much. Creative writing was my favorite thing, but it's not because I wasn't good at math, and it's not because I was afraid of math. It is because in math class, we were not allowed to talk. We were not allowed to ask questions. We were not allowed to be curious. And creativity wasn't really a thing. So I learned at a very young age that asking questions in math class gets you called out. Or maybe that was just my fourth grade math class where the teacher called me names and told me to stop asking so many questions and to just follow the steps. You know, some that I remember, Little Miss Smarty Pants, Little Miss Know-It-All, and Grandma was another one because I had those little black rim glasses that was the only style available for a little head. So I just remember the negative experience with showing up curious in math class. So while I continued to excel, which was easy, you just had to be, you know, a rule follower, Gen X in the house. We are the rule followers of all rule followers. So I maintained straight A's, had perfect scores in all kinds of state tests in New York, and hated math and couldn't wait till I could stop taking math. I opted out after trigonometry because the counselors said I could. I think it's ridiculous that she didn't try to stop me since I was a straight A student with no struggles, but that's where it ended for me. College, yes, I took pre-calculus and some of the other required things, but I focused on literacy and eventually earned my undergraduate degree in early childhood speech communications and my master's degree in educational studies with a concentration in, you guessed it, literacy. So how did I end up in the math space? What in the world? My last course in my master's program was an elective, and I just took a math methods course to fill the spot, to be quite honest, and everything changed. I had the professor who answered all the questions that I had growing up, all the questions that I wondered and kept to myself, and for the first time, I realized that there were answers. And then I became enraged, like, why don't we tell the children? You know, so it became my mission that all the things I had done to support literacy, coaching, mentoring other teachers, doing summer intensive with children, getting them to read and become better writers, I wanted to do that on the math side. And for me, that meant not long after finishing my master's, I tried to find a second master's program for elementary mathematics, and there wasn't one that existed. Right. So I created my own graduate extension, I guess you could say, because it didn't end with a degree. But I did get some endorsements in elementary mathematics, teacher development, because I knew I was going to want to share it with other teachers. And I just decided that it was my job to step over into the elementary math space because there weren't a lot of people doing it there. And that is why now even my book is focused on bringing together literacy and mathematics, because I think it would be really powerful to teachers, for teachers and leaders, to recognize that everything you need to teach mathematics well already exists inside of you. So we can talk more about that as we continue this conversation.
I do have one question before we go on to our next one. A lot of times in schools, the emphasis is on literacy more than it is on mathematics regarding the schedules, time allotments, all the things.
I had the same question, Karen. It was like popped in my head. I was like, oh my gosh. So.
All right.
I'm ready for you. I am ready all for right. you. See, because the reason why we need to have this conversation, first of all, yes, the NAEP scores, they're terrible. They're awful. It's abysmal. Well, first of all, it was already terrible before the pandemic. That's just not new news. But we send all the resources to the grades that didn't do well. Grade four, the scores weren't great, so let's support them. But we should be supporting pre-K through fourth if we really want to see a difference in fourth. Same with eighth. Oh, send all the resources. They need coaches. They need support. And you should really be supporting everything beforehand. But here's the other part. Reading is important. Or when I was growing up, they said reading is fundamental. But research has shown us, starting with Duncan and his research team, that it is early math skills that is the number one predictor for overall academic success, even more so than reading and writing. But also, early math skills give us a glimpse of lifelong earning potential. So we should be supporting early math skills and the development of these foundational skills in mathematics for all students. And here's the other hiccup. The teachers who teach our youngest learners often have their own not so great relationship with mathematics, maybe some math trauma, maybe some math anxiety, and maybe they're not as equipped to teach mathematics with confidence because so much emphasis is put on teaching reading and writing in undergraduate programs and in graduate programs that teachers are often put in situations where they need to teach math in the way they didn't learn it. Mm-hmm. And because of their own negative relationship with mathematics, they have a difficult time enjoying and leaning into struggle with learning or understanding math concepts in this new way, or understanding the math they teach deeply and in a conceptual way. So while I agree, I told you, I love words, reading, literacy, all things, my favorite, my first love. But I understand that if we want to see improvement overall, we have to start to address the issues with the teaching of mathematics in the early grades.
I like how you said the resources, because I was having a conversation with another math coach the other day, and we're like, well, they have we have these reading specialists in these grades, and they're reading coaches, and they're reading and literacy, and then we're getting rid of a tier three math program in one side. It's like the resources are being, all the resources and money are being towards literacy, and we really haven't seen a hit or an impact in ELA across the state, at least in California, the state of California, or in our schools. But math has continued to stay low, and they wonder why math is not growing when they're not putting any resources to it. And so I think the resources are really important, like you mentioned. And one of those resources is, I think, coaching the teachers. And I know that we know that that positive student math identities is so important, and we've been working on that. And we know that that's important for student success. But you mentioned that it's also really, really important for teachers to have that positive math identity also. So I guess the question is, like, why is it so important? And what can we do to help teachers?
Okay, so this is a big question, but there definitely are some things that we can do to support teachers. And I'm also going to tell you that it is really important to consider teacher math identity, because you can't nurture positive math identities in your students when you're fighting against your own negative math identity. Does it happen that sometimes children still make it through and eventually become super excited and fall in love with mathematics? Yes. But the ideal situation would be that, just like we teach reading from a place of a love of reading, kids are nervous about becoming readers, but we're so excited reading the stories and doing the voices. And it's as if the joy and enthusiasm and our love for story oozes out of us, spills over, and children kind of grab onto that. And I personally remember teaching reading and saying, oh, it's time for reading. I'm so excited. Just all of this energy. And writers, where are my writers? And I'm super excited. And then math class was, please turn to page 237 in your math book. And the energy shifted. That's the first reason. The second reason is, if we're holding on to our own traumas, we're holding on to our own anxiety, and it's interfering with us really digging in and learning the content and learning the mathematics conceptually, then we disrupt sense making for students. For example, a student has this really cool creative strategy that they just thought of because intuitively they realize that there's a pattern here and they can play with the numbers and make it work for them. And I'm an insecure teacher or a teacher whose confidence is low. And what I say is, whoa, don't do that. That is not what the teacher's guide says. I need you to come back to the thing that I know and feel comfortable with. And if a student says, but I got the right answer, will it work every time? And my answer is, I don't know, but I need you to not do it that way. So now we have this budding mathler who is excited about sharing their thinking, exercising their sense-making superpower, and we're shutting them down. So imagine if that happens over and over again. So that's another example. When students are stuck and we need to push them along in their thinking, you have to be able to ask just the right question to nudge them forward. In order for that to happen, you again need to have that deep understanding. You need to play around with the math for yourself. You need to understand the math conceptually, and you need to know the coherence of the math concepts across grades so you can go a little bit back to ask the question, to nudge them forward just a little bit, to move them to more sophisticated strategies and thinking requires me to deeply understand this math that I'm teaching and sharing with students. If you offer professional learning and teachers get to opt in, because we should have choice, right? Am I ever going to choose the additional math professional learning if I myself am afraid of math or don't feel that I am a math person? Yes, I'm doing air quotes, even though it's an audio recording. It's like, those are the types of things we need to think about, and leaders who model that you don't have to really know math to lead math. So how do you know what great math teaching looks like if you're avoiding math for yourself? So it even goes beyond the teachers and also the leaders, especially those who are instructional leaders and going into classrooms, and a teacher who is not feeling confident or competent with their math teaching sees you come in with a clipboard. And now I am having my own issue and can't really teach the children because I'm so distracted because of the disruption to the classroom, which is I'm now being judged, evaluated, and you're having these feelings. And the last thing I would say is we have to go back and heal the little person in us who maybe was, you know, having a hard time with subtracting across zeros. And now we're 34 years old. And when you ask someone, why are you not a math person? Or why do you believe that? And they say, subtracting across zeros was so hard. Well, you're 34 now. So let's talk about it. Can we let that go so we can move forward? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do we support teachers in making that shift? Carve out time for teachers and coaches to play with mathematics and to experience mathematics as a learner without the pressure of, and now go do it with the kids. Like, give me a moment, have a session, have that embedded PD that is me doing the math for me. Me not pretending to be a third grader. What do you think a third grader would do? No, just me learning how to do this and noticing patterns for myself and trying out new strategies and connecting mathematical ideas based on what my colleagues are sharing, but also based on my own intuition that has been maybe suppressed. Mm-hmm. So you asked the wrong question if you didn't want all the business, because that is something that matters so much to me. And it's why I'm focusing my dissertation research on that very thing, building up comfort with mathematics so that we can build competence with mathematics so that we can go forward and teach with confidence, be willing to collaborate and build a community of mathers. That's the comfort before confidence framework that I'm introducing in my dissertation research.
So I have another question.
Okay.
So thinking about the schools that I went through to get to the point where I am, I didn't go the traditional route. But I started off in a private school, and then I moved into public school, and then I had to do all the things so that I could be licensed by the state. The majority of my classes were based in literacy. And back then, the programs that teachers were going through did end up spending more time in literacy and math. In your experience, you may or may not know, but I'm just throwing it out there. Do you feel that higher education has come a little bit further along in allowing teachers to do exactly what you just said in terms of when you are learning how to teach math, that it is important to do the math and to play the math and encouraging that, not just whatever it is that they do when they end up in a school and they're doing their internship and they get to experience, but that whole piece of the importance. Because like right now with teachers, one of the things that we're focused on, we're like going into year three of our curriculum implementation. And so we know how to open the book. We know how to read the book. We know how to do everything that's in the book. But really integrating in that craft, the bringing it to life off the paper. And we're really encouraging anticipating student responses. But in order to anticipate student responses, you have to know what they're going to do so that you can be planned with those questions, scaffolds, and et cetera. So that's what led me to think about what they're doing beforehand. You know, the ones that we just get off the street who are just like, I want to teach now. And we say, come on. We know we have to wrap our hands around them and give them all the things. But for those who went the traditional route and they went through these four-year programs, five if they have their master's, what sense do you have in terms of whether we're closer to preparing teachers to teach math than we were before?
Well, my first thought is the National Council on Teacher Quality continues to assess programs across the nation. And also at the beginning of my doctoral program, I looked at the comparison between what's offered for preparing teachers to teach reading and preparing teachers to teach mathematics. And it was 6-1 when I started my program in 2022. That for every 6 literacy courses, there was 1 math course. That's not enough. But just recently, they came out and they have gone back and evaluated programs again to see if we've seen a great shift, a lot of improvement. And of course, we can share this resource, you know, in your show notes, because it's still disheartening that even some of the top programs at some of the top universities across the country are not doing a really great job with preparing teachers, especially elementary teachers who are going to be generalists, which is a lot to ask in the first place, but there's an imbalance in how we're preparing them to teach reading and writing. And writing doesn't even get as much attention as it should, but reading and mathematics and those programs that are making improvements have, you know, thought about things like, understanding the content deeply, understanding instruction, math instruction. And so it's the combination of pedagogical content knowledge, but also instructional practices. And then you add on the layer of then understanding the curriculum that your school or district is using. And a lot of PL that is even offered is about how to navigate the website of the math program, not how to understand the math and how it's being presented in the program. So with all of that, sadly, I think the answer is not really. We have not made as much progress as we would like to think that we have. Of course, there are pockets. Of course, there are new programs. I know I work with Mount Holyoke, and the Math Ed Leadership Program is fantastic. And that's one of the places I first really heard talking about looking at teachers as sitting in the seat of the learner, the analyst, and the practitioner. So you need time to learn the math for yourself, play with the manipulatives for yourself, do the work of the lesson yourself. Then you also need time to, as an analyst, to look at student work and student thinking and understand what were they thinking here through that asset lens. What do they know? It's the wrong answer, but what do they know? And then as a practitioner, thinking about what practices do I need to start, stop, and change, you know, as I go back into the classroom based on the feedback that I received from, whether it's a summative assessment, formative assessment, it's supposed to be about understanding what the students know so that I can continue to build on that. And when you think about cognitively guided instruction, same thing, looking at student work, looking at student thinking, anticipating what they'll do next. All of that comes back to, do I know and understand the math well enough to make those decisions, to anticipate what students are going to say, think, do, their partial conceptions. Maybe it's a misconception, but most often it's a partial conception. They know something and they're missing a piece. It is also necessary for true scaffolding that is successful for us to really understand it, because if not, we over-scaffold. We give the scaffold in advance just in case they need it. And we remove the cognitive demand, and that's where the learning happens. So we want to keep the cognitive load light, but we want the cognitive demand to be there. All of those things require us to have that comfort, competence, and confidence. Like, I'm going to keep going back to that because that's really what is getting in the way of us really doing a better job with teaching elementary mathematics, is supporting the teachers with building up their own comfort so they can really dig into the content and teach mathematics with more confidence.
It's funny you mentioned Mount Holyoke. We had a guest, I don't know if you've listened, and we had a guest earlier that does the work there. And yep. So that's really awesome to hear some positive feedback about her work. And if you haven't, those of you that haven't listened, if you haven't listened to our conversation with Marta Garcia, I recommend you go back and take a listen to that. So we've talked a lot about teachers and teachers having positive math identities and the places where hopefully we can train. It is really sad to hear 6-to-1, especially when the research, as you mentioned before, the research is starting to show that math skills are a real predictor of how well students will do academically later on in their lives. So you use the term, peruse around the website, really beautiful website. Those of you that go and take a look, peruse around and right away, the term mather comes up. I love the term. So for our listeners, can you just explain what a mather is and why it's so important for all kids to believe that they are mathers? Just like I think we want teachers to believe that they're mathers too.
Absolutely. A mather is simply a person who uses mathematics to make sense of the world. And when we think of the NCTM math identity work that was done, why is it escaping me at this moment? K-8 math identity, they define math identity as what we believe and what others believe about us with our ability to do mathematics, but it's that last part where they say, and the ability to use mathematics in powerful ways across the context of our lives. So to be a mather is to have a relationship with mathematics outside of the classroom. We come here with that. We come here with math intuition. We come here with brains that are pre-wired to recognize patterns. But somewhere along the line, experiences make us believe that we can just lose it. And that's not what's actually happening. So if I know that I am a reader, whether or not I love it, whether or not I choose a career where I can read professionally, I don't know that that's a thing, maybe a proofreader. But regardless of that, I can hold on to being a reader as a part of my identity. The same is true for writer. I could be a writer, even if I don't become, a novelist, a journalist, or anything that my profession involves a lot of writing. But then there's math, where you're a person who likes math, you're good at math. You don't like math? A mathematician is a career choice. So if I don't choose that career, then I guess I'm done with math. There was no way to keep identifying with math outside of the path of becoming a mathematician, which can be intimidating for many, especially given the stereotypes on every movie that ever mentions anything that has to do with mathematics. You must be nerdy with thick glasses and wild hair and, solve problems all by yourself with a wall that is a chalkboard or a whiteboard, something unreasonable. So I stop identifying with that and say things like, oh, I don't use math. I'm not good at math. I don't really know math, but we use it every day in all of our lives. And I challenge you to find a career, a hobby, or anything that you love to do that doesn't involve mathematics. Even simple things like getting somewhere on time, planning how you're going to get somewhere. There are just so many connections to anything you want to do. So to be a mather is to say, yeah, I failed my fractions test, but I'm still a mather. Not, I failed fractions. Now I'm no longer a math anything. I'm not good at math. And when students say, I'm just not good at math, the first thing we should ask is what part? Because when we make it singular, can you be just bad at math? Like everything in the realm of mathematics? No, that is an impossibility. So in other countries where they say maths, plural, that makes sense. And in elementary school, I always had my students say mathematics. And we never just said math, math, math. And it's because we want students to recognize that math is many things. And in the book that's coming out, well, by the time this airs, it will be out. One of the features that I love and I'm really proud of is a feature called Where's the Math in That? That happens at the end of every chapter, where I've interviewed people who I happen to know in all different areas that use math in ways that we're not thinking about, like a musician or an actress, an artist. I have an entrepreneur, a lacrosse coach. And I remember even in the interview with the lacrosse coach, where she's going on about math and how it wasn't really ever her thing. And then she is explaining how lacrosse works. And I had to ask her to slow down because she was saying all these things that were just like, wait, and a 2-7 and a what now? What? Hold on. And she paused and she said, huh, I guess there is quite a bit of math in lacrosse, huh? You know, just you don't think about it that way, but the math is there. And the triple threat actress, singer, dancer, she said, I didn't really think about it being math when we were in the band room and they're talking about the configurations on the field and how if you step to the left, the trombone's going to hit you in the head. You know, so that was all mathematics and the dance routines and how the music is on one count, but the dance moves are on a different count. And you don't want to end up in the wrong spot on the stage, on the field, or anywhere you're performing. And that's math. Spatial awareness is math. Choreography and the counts, like all of the ways that math is a part of our lives, we lose if we allow people to believe that you either are a mathematician or nothing. You're either a math person who did well in math class or you're not. And that's just not true. And societally, it happened, I believe, because of the history of mathematics being elitist. And math wasn't for everyone by design. They only wanted common people, common folks, not including women or girls, but that's another story, to be computers, human computers. Well, we all know that we don't need human computers anymore because we have phones, which are computers in our hands. So the reason why I advocate for the term mather to be added to our vocabulary is so that when I ask students, are you a reader? They may or may not say yes or no. But if I say, can you read? They say yes. I said, then you're a reader. Now my other question would be, but do you love reading? So can you write? Okay, then you're a writer. Do you love writing? That's okay if you don't. Can you math? Math deserves a verb too. Then you're a mather. And even if you don't like it, you're still a mather. And you don't get to opt out like I did. Why do we let kids opt out? Oh, no, you don't have to take any more math. Don't even worry about it. You can choose a major so that you can avoid math. We expect to read and write in every other content area, but we don't expect to bring math with us into every other area. And I'm proud to say that I had little mathers who were mathing in the hallway, in the cafeteria, debating about how math can help them solve problems without it being corny. And we even hosted math parties for the adults so that we could play around with math. I know that's actually kind of corny, but it worked.
You touched on so many things that resonated with me. I used to choreograph dance for a group. And, you know, you just brought back memories of. So I did dance class as well. I started off when I was really young, left it for a while, and then did dance again when I was in college. Something as basic as the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 2 and 3, 4, you know, like the whole, the rhythm and so forth at its core is rooted in mathematics. And when you think about the pirouettes and the momentum that you use to lift yourself, to make turns, to do leaps and
all the batting,
things, which I never got right.
I mean, just the science, the physics, the math. I mean, like it's all in there. And it's saddening that how much math is truly in everything that we do wasn't taught to us in that way. It wasn't shown to us in that way. And that we had those experiences of just being quiet and raising our hands and turning to page 232 and answering all the right questions. My youngest son, you know, will say that he's not the strongest math person. His spatial awareness is like out of this world.
Yes.
And I watched him play Fortnite. And there's this thing that they do where they pull up these maps and graphs and they like build walls instantly in seconds to like block somebody from shooting them. And I'm like,
hey, you are mathing.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
But I had to call him out on that and let him know, like, hey, like, you may not be experiencing strength in this area, but you definitely have it in this area because everybody can't do what you're doing there, you know? So helping them to see that it's just so much more than just this page, this number, this book, and this random problem that doesn't make sense to me because I'm never going to encounter it in my life.
Yeah. Math is gonna math everywhere we turn. We are mathing, and that is that's our job to help make this shift, is to point out those moments. Vanessa Vaccaria talks about her band member who said he's not a math person, but he's the one who always has to pack the trunk so that everything fits. You know, it's like, again, spatial awareness. And my son was the same way. He came here with the brain of an engineer, the mind of an engineer. And even though my father was very much against it, he taught himself to crochet from watching us crochet and made some of the craziest things, of course, to impress girls. And he figured out that mathematical thing that I'm sitting and teaching my daughters and their friends how to crochet. And he would just ask his sister, can I borrow one of your needles? Can you have some yarn you don't want? And then he would like make a sea creature or a snowman wearing a hat filled with rice so that it would sit up on the table to impress some girl with a little gift or something. He saw the patterns. He understood it. And we don't talk about crocheting being mathematical, but my goodness, the designs, the quilting, the just all of it. So you cannot avoid mathematics, so we may as well embrace it as a part of our identity and decide with which parts of it we love and which parts of it we don't love. I told my students every year, once I became aware, because, you know, I told you literacy was my first love, but my job is not to make you fall in love with mathematics. Well, I hope it happens, maybe, but my job is to make sure that you are comfortable with mathematics, that you approach unfamiliar problems with confidence, just as they did with unfamiliar words. We had an etymology notebook in third grade, understanding how words are made so that you, when you face unfamiliar words, you have the tools to break it down or to problem solve. I want the same for you on the math side. And I most importantly want you to not cut off your life options, because we impact the trajectory of students' lives when we let them opt out of mathematics at an early age, and later they decide they want to be something where that high-level mathematics is important. And they should be able to get there and say, I could do this, but I've decided to take a different path. Not, I really wanted to take this path, but math is now an obstacle. We want it to be a bridge, not a barrier.
Yeah, we could have an entire podcast on that discussion alone.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I've loved everything that we've talked about. Math is going to math. That's everyone. I know that there's conversations in my house where we talk about 3-4 time and 4-4 time because all my kids play music and they'll make jokes. Yeah, they'll make jokes about, 8-12, what's going on with this song? And then my daughter knew how to manipulate fractions, I think by third grade, because she was in drum lessons. And so she had to understand the timing. And I thought, man, it's everywhere. Fractions aren't scary if we don't make them scary. And I think a lot of times we institutionalized the scariness and fear of numbers into our education. So, love to hear more of that. And I know we're coming up to our time here. We talked about so much stuff. Karen, I think this happens every episode. We get to this time, we're like, oh my gosh, we could talk for another hour or so. But as we wrap up, Deborah, I'm just so happy that you were on our podcast this month. And we ask everyone our first question, but we just kept going. We kept rolling. So I'm going to take our first question and ask it at the end here. So the series, this first series for us is titled Everyone Belongs in Mathematics.
Yes.
So our leading question now becomes our last question for this one. For all our guests out there, what does it mean to belong in mathematics?
I would say first and foremost that you get to show up with all of your incomplete ideas and questions and wonderings, and that you're still accepted, embraced, and that your thinking is honored, even if you don't get the right answer. Because while getting the right answer is important, it is a part of the process, it is eventually what we would love to do, I think the journey along the way is where the belonging actually formulates. That I can think of my third graders, one year in particular, where we had established a culture of belonging and that it was a space where you could admit you didn't know. And it was on the reading side. That book is a little too challenging for me. Thanks for the recommendation, but I might read that with my parent, or I might have to wait till next year. And on the math side, when I took those solutions, sometimes we think with warm-ups and it's like, just keep accepting solutions, keep your game face on, don't let them know which one is the right solution by your reaction, and then talk about it. It was beautiful to see students say, I'd like to change my answer. And not just because the popular kid said something else, but because they had made the connection and seen the error in their thinking by listening to the explanation of someone else, and they can now articulate, oh, I thought this, but now I understand this, and I'd like to agree with Karen. So to be able to do that, you must feel like you belong, even when your thinking is different. And I loved hearing students who, they were the only ones who believed an answer, right or wrong, didn't matter. But they were willing to take the risk and explain their thinking and reasoning and be okay, even if in the end, their answer wasn't correct, because others listened to why they thought that. And their classmates learned to say, I could see how you would think that, but don't forget you need to also remember to put the one back because you took it out. Just having those conversations openly and honestly, and then closing out sometimes and saying, we saw a lot of different strategies that I have up here on the board. And I'm just wondering if there's anyone who had your thinking that has maybe changed, or you're going to try a different strategy next time. Just come up to the board and just tap the strategy that's resonating with you. And they'd walk up and tap it and go back and write in their journals their reflection. I'm going to try Abel's strategy next time because it was a lot easier once I understood what he was doing. So the sense of belonging for me is not that it's a safe space, because is there such a thing? But, I love the term and I'd love to credit it to the right person, but brave spaces, it's escaping me right now, but that you establish the space where students are comfortable enough to step into a space without knowing and trust that they will be accepted in their moment of misunderstanding or ignorance and supported to get to a place of knowing and understanding with the help of their community of mathers.
As Abel said, we could go on and on and on and on. And for our listeners who have thoroughly enjoyed this episode of Learning with Leaders, if you haven't already registered for the conference with the theme Rise Up, Deborah will be our closing keynote. I believe she's also on the docket for a couple of sessions. And it would be an awesome treat if you didn't have her on your list before, put her on your list now and check her out and hang around for the keynote so that you can hear some more of the awesome goodness that she has shared with us today. I have learned a ton, as I do always. But before we end, how can our listeners learn a little bit more about you, in addition to just going to the conference? But if they just want to just learn more about your work, how can they find you?
The easiest way is mathersgonnamath.com. If you go there, you can find us on all the social media platforms, which the handle is going to be mathersgonnamath on LinkedIn, on Blue Sky. We're working on it. We're working on it. Instagram. Just Mathers Gonna Math. If you look that up, you will find me.
Thank you.
It's an easy one to remember. So, all right, we thank everybody for listening. Before we leave off here, I know that this is our September podcast, and I don't think our October one's going to come out before the conference. So I do want to let everyone know that Karen and I are going to have a live broadcast.
Yes.
At the conference. So any of you regular listeners that want to come and participate in a live broadcast, we'd love to have you there. I'm not sure which session it is or where we're at, but look it up when you get there. And we'd love to have people join us.
Yay.
Sounds like fun. Yeah.
It's going to be fun.
It's going to be lots of fun. All right. So we want to, again, thank you, Deborah, for coming here and spreading just some great math joy with everyone. And we thank everybody for listening this month, and we'll hope to hear you soon.
All right. Thanks for having me. Bye.
We hope that you have been inspired by this bold mathematics leadership conversation, and we'll tune in to our podcast series each month. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. You can learn more about NCSM leadership and mathematics education and our upcoming professional learning events on the NCSM website, mathedleadership.com. You can also follow NCSM on the X at mathedleaders and using the hashtag NCSMBold. Until next time.